I am Dr. David Stevens, the CEO of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations, the largest Christian professional medical organization in the United States. Thank you for joining us. I wanted to update you on the important issue of right of conscience. Our members have told us in surveys and one-on-one how important this issue is to them because it'll affect their practice of medicine. Actually, it's an issue important for every citizen in this country because right of conscience is enshrined in the First Amendment. With everything happening in the public square, with the Supreme Court listening to oral debates just recently on the contraceptive mandate issue, which has great bearing on right of conscience, I wanted to get you the latest information and analysis of what is happening to bring you up to date, and also to spend some time giving you information that'll help you tell others the importance of this issue as you're around the water cooler at work or at church or whatever. Our first guest is the Honorable Senator Tom Coburn. Senator Coburn has a long and distinguished career in public service as well as in medicine. Prior to that, he was actually educated with an accounting degree at Oklahoma State University and worked in his dad's business for a few years. When that business was sold, he returned, went to medical school, did an OBGYN residency and practice for over a decade before in 1995 he became a representative from Oklahoma from the 2nd Congressional District to the U.S. Congress. He served in that capacity in 2001, and in 2004 he ran for the Senate and was successful and planning to serve two terms there. In fact, he's drawing to a close to a second term not too far in the future. He's focused his career on reducing wasteful spending, we're all for that, protecting your liberty, especially right of conscience, balancing the budget, improving health care access and affordability, and protecting the sanctity of human life. We caught him on a very busy day in the Senate, so you'll see that this interview moves very quickly, but I think the information that he's going to share with you would be very helpful to you as we move forward. Tell us about the Health Care Conscience Rights Act, Senator. We're all very concerned as Christian doctors about the impact of right of conscience issues on our practice and on us personally. Tell us what's going on.
This is a bill that inserts conscience protections into the Affordable Care Act to prevent businesses, individuals, that's i.e. physicians as well, from being forced to comply with Health and Human Services mandates. So what it does is it gives conscience protections for healthcare providers similar to the Abortion Non-Discrimination Act so that doctors, nurses aren't forced to perform or assist in any objectionable healthcare services like abortions or morning after or whatever. And it also adds a clarification that it doesn't allow individuals to violate the civil rights, the Pregnancy Non-Discrimination Act, the Americans with Disabilities Act. In other words, we keep all the other protections in there, and we explicitly say so, but we come back and say, in terms of the Affordable Care Act, we're going to reassert the right of professionals to not violate their conscience, regardless of what the government says.
And doesn't this, for the first time, give individuals the right for legal action if their conscience is violated?
They'll have a right of action in a court of law.
And which is something different than anything that I know of that's on the books. You've been dealing with a lot of other issues as well, but let me just, first of all, kind of get your feedback on what you think is going to happen with the contraceptive mandate. And we just heard about it in the Supreme Court not long ago.
Well, I don't know. We thought, other than John Roberts abandoning common sense, we thought that the Affordable Care Act, as far as the mandate, would have been taken out. It wasn't. So I don't think you can predict what the Supreme Court is going to do.
Yeah.
We know what's right. And we know what's wrong, but unfortunately in our country anymore, we can't count on the Supreme Court to come down on the side of right all the time.
Yeah, and not to be predictable either.
Right.
You've entered put another bill in, cutting the Costly Codes Act. I doubt many of our members know about that, but all of them know about ICD-10 and what the impact of that is. Tell us the thrust of what you were trying to do.
It's all about ICD-10. Is our estimate is if you force ICD-10 into the healthcare industry at this time, you're going to add $14 billion a year to the cost of care, which means doctors, because they're liable under Medicare and Medicaid, if they get it wrong, are going to spend a whole lot of time going through three to four times as many codes to get it right as they would otherwise. That's time that they're going to be doing paperwork that's not going to give any significant value to anybody that's caring for people. It'll give some value to the public health community in terms of how they analyze data, but it won't do anything to improve people's care. Our problem right now is we're not getting our caregivers enough time to spend with patients to find out what's really wrong with them, and this goes against that. So not only is it costly, it's going to result in poorer care, not better care.
And I know that's the concern that our, you know, CMDA members have, and that's where your real satisfaction in medicine comes from. I mean, is those relationships that you have and the ability to really deal with people's issues. You also introduced the Patient Care Act. Tell us about that. I think our members really need to understand that there's an alternative out there, and a very good one, to what we're seeing in the Affordable Care Act.
The Patient Care Act, first thing it does is repeal Obamacare. And then it takes what's good in Obamacare, like no lifetime limits, continuous coverage, no denial of pre-existing illnesses, and then builds a market-based model based on that, so that we don't have the government choosing what doctor, what plan, what you must buy and what you can't buy. It allows real market forces for once to interject themselves into health care. You get to buy what you want. You can buy across state lines. You can come together with groups and buy. In other words, what we want, everything else in our economy today, we allocate resources on the basis of markets. And what the Affordable Care Act did is went exactly the wrong direction, with proscriptive government-directed rules that actually lessen competition and lessen this better allocation of a scarce resource called health care.
You know, your estimate is estimated by some of those people that do those type of things that this will decrease costs by $1.5 trillion over 10 years, and yet it not change real coverage for people, actually even lower their premiums. How's it going to do that?
Well, it's just by allocating. Right now, just think what's happening right now. We don't have any real competition. You get to choose between three plans, basically, three levels of plans and maybe a couple multitudes. But every one of those, are, in most instances, is more expensive with a much higher deductible. You know, and what you ought to be able to buy is what fits you and your family and has the provider group that you want for your family. And so what you'll see is competition within the insurance industry and innovation in the industry. One of the sad facts about the Affordable Care Act is most of the people signing up had insurance coverage before. Now they have poor insurance coverage and coverage for things they don't necessarily want with much higher deductibles. So what you'll do is you'll take this tremendous expansion in costs and bring it back down.
Senator Coburn, we thank you for your time, and let us be thinking about, too, praying for you. I know you're dealing with prostate cancer and all the challenges of that, as well as your tremendously busy schedule. But just thank you for representing the Lord, representing righteousness, and being a great government leader for all of us in healthcare and people in your home state.
Well, I really appreciate that. I'm doing well.
Great, great.
Thank you. God bless you.
God bless you. Well, great interview, and I wish we just had more time to talk to him. Apologize a little bit for that static. It's hard to get a cell phone signal out of the Capitol building with all that marble around, but I think you were able to hear the meat of what he had to say. Our next guest is Casey Maddox, who's a senior counsel for Alliance Defending Freedom, a great organization that CMDA partners with amicus curiae briefs on important court cases, both at the federal and local level on a wide range of ethical issues. Casey lives in Burke, Virginia with his wife Samantha and their daughter Madeline. He graduated from Boston College Law School and clerked at the Alabama Supreme Court before starting to work with the Christian Legal Society, and now serves with the Alliance Defending Freedom. He's got some great information for us that I think is going to help you very practically in dealing with the issues of right of conscience, not only in the big picture, but in what you're dealing with at the local level as well. Casey, it's great to talk to you again, and all of you at the Alliance Defending Freedom have just been in the forefront of this right of conscience issue. Tell us what's happening. Let's start on the legal front with what happened in the Supreme Court and the Hobby Lobby case, and where you're seeing all that going, not only in the Supreme Court, but where the other cases are now.
Sure. Well, we're very hopeful after the argument in the Supreme Court. It's always difficult to try to judge based on the questions were being asked, but at the same time, we were happy with what we were hearing, I guess, from several of the justices. And so it gives us a lot of hope that the court's going to reach the right decision here. Of course, we think that on the merits going into the argument, there's just no way to decide that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act does not protect Hobby Lobby and Conestoga in these cases. It's clear, and we think the court, we're very hopeful that the court will say that in June.
What kind of questions were you hearing? What gave you that encouragement?
Well, among other things, the concern toward the end of the argument from Justice Kennedy that, according to the argument from the government, there is no reason why the government could not simply impose, if they were correct, they could simply impose a requirement that everyone had to provide abortion coverage, elective abortion coverage, and there would be no argument for any for-profit employer because there would be no conscience rights of any kind, religious conscience rights at least, for any for-profit employer. So it takes it out of an argument about contraception or you know, well, exactly what do certain drugs do, and sort of makes the issue much more direct that, look, you know, you can set aside all those particular questions as a legal principle. What the government is arguing for here is an attack on conscience rights completely.
Yeah. And therefore, any so-called secular organization could not have any religious principles, even if it was a closely held family business like Hobby Lobby.
That's exactly right. If you go into business, you have to choose between making money or having your faith, but you cannot have both. That was the position from the government, and I didn't hear a whole lot of support for that idea in the courtroom last week in the oral arguments, so that's encouraging.
I was watching on National Public TV last night a thing on the Jews, and, you know, they were talking about in Russia that they would not allow them to be in the professions, they would not allow them to do certain businesses if they were going to practice that faith. And here we're talking about the same thing in the U.S., which is, you know, just kind of unbelievable.
That's exactly right. And we've in fact, had amicus briefs that were filed by Jewish organizations making a very similar point that, look, throughout history, there is a tight connection between attacks on Jews and attacks on their businesses. And so this idea that one's faith and one's business are completely separate things and have to be kept completely separately has not been how the world has viewed that for millennia.
If we win this case that's before the Supreme Court, what's going to happen with all the other cases that have, you know, they're really less contentious in some ways, at least the ones dealing with, you know, the Little Sisters of Mercy and these groups? Is this going to kind of just sweep the whole thing at one time, or are we going to be seeing a series of cases winding their way up to the Supreme Court to deal with this issue?
I think we'll have to see based on exactly what the court says, which is a bit of a non-answer for you, I know, but we'll have to see exactly what the court says. The nonprofit cases, because the government had supposedly created a kind of workaround, which we say doesn't resolve the conscience issue at all, that might still be at issue. But no doubt at all, if we get a decision from the Supreme Court saying that this cannot be imposed on Hobby Lobby and on Conestoga, it will have very positive ramifications for the other cases around the country. It's just a question of how positive will it answer those cases and end them, or will there be follow-up questions to be asked?
How's this going to impact healthcare professionals, especially those in practice, either private practice or who are, you know, employees?
Well, you know, I think one thing we're seeing in these cases is a shift from abortion rights language to abortion access arguments. This is on trial in the Hobby Lobby and Conestoga cases, but it's something that, you know, in another context is playing out in conscience rights cases for medical professionals elsewhere. And that change is one, we've seen this before in the early 70s, around the time of Roe, there was an effort to try to compel faith-based hospitals to provide abortion services in their hospitals. And those arguments were rejected, and the Supreme Court, even in Roe and in Doe, basically said that we don't have to worry about the possibility that people will be forced to assist in abortion because the AMA House of Delegates says here we would never do such a thing. They, of course, changed that position later. But those things are right there in Roe and Doe. And so for a long time after that, particularly because, frankly, you had pro-life Democrats like Ted Kennedy, who stood up on the floor of the Senate and supported the church amendments and other conscience protections and said, look, we're going to allow for abortion, but we're not going to force people to assist in abortions. And so for a long time, you had the rights language was the operative language that was used on the other side. And we're seeing a shift back now to this access argument, where if anyone makes even the most minor conscience argument at all and says, look, I just don't want to participate, that's not viewed with some sort of deference from the supporters of abortion. That is a war on women. And unfortunately, now you don't have the old Ted Kennedy, the early 70s Ted Kennedy, to stand up on the Democratic side and say, no, no, that's not fair. In order to draw some peace here in the public square, we have to be able to have people to disagree on this and not force people to do things that violate their conscience. We don't have that right now on the Democratic side of the aisle. And we'll see how this plays out. But that's why it's so critical, I think, that the Supreme Court reject this access argument, this idea that people have a constitutional right to force others to do things that violate their conscience.
Yeah.
Has a lot of ramifications for healthcare professionals and how those cases will, how those arguments will play out in that context.
Right. It's really right of conscience versus right of convenience. I don't have to drive
right.
so far. I don't have to, you know, get in the phone book and find someone. You've got to do this for me. When do you think we're ever going to get a right of private action on right of conscience issue? Because, I mean, as I look at this, after the years that, you know, I'm not nearly dealing with the legal issues like you every day, but when you look at 40% of our members saying that they have been, you know, been efforts to discriminate against them based on a conscience issue, and 25% that's actually resulted in loss of income. It's resulted in loss of promotion, loss of educational opportunity, all those type of things. I don't see this changing at the grassroots level until there's an opportunity to turn around and say, you're discriminating against me based on my religious principles, and therefore you can be sued. Because I think until that point happens, it's going to continue.
Yeah, I agree. That is critical. I mean, we've had the Church Amendments, the Coates-Snow Amendment, the Public Health Service Act, and the Weldon Amendment. Those are all great. Those are wonderful protections, but they're simply paper and not much more. If you don't have the ability to enforce them, particularly if you have an administration that doesn't want to enforce them,
right.
Which is the enforcement mechanism that you do have under those. So you can point to them and you can make, it's almost like a moral case that you're making to point to laws that prohibit this. So it is critically important, and I know that there is a bill in Congress that would do that. I think that bill would have no difficulty getting through the House at this point, but it would obviously run into opposition in the Senate and in the White House. So it may be simply a question of political will, that once you have people in both houses and in the White House who are willing to say that conscience is important, you know, I don't expect that at any point in my lifetime, at least barring Jesus' return, I don't expect that we're going to have unity on the question of abortion.
Right.
But we ought to at least be able to say that if we're not going to have that unity, we're not going to force everybody to do things that violate their conscience. And so hopefully, you're right. If we had that sort of protection, the ability to enforce those rights, that seems to me like the live and let live policy that people on both sides of the aisle should be reaching for.
You know, we wouldn't have civil rights in this country if they just passed a law that had no right of private action or enforcement built into it.
That's exactly right. I always say that only lawyers could come up with this idea that we're going to pass laws that protect you except give you absolutely no way to enforce those laws.
Yeah.
I always feel bad trying to explain to medical professionals that somehow this is an answer that attorneys came up with, and it just makes no sense whatsoever.
It gives covering, but it doesn't provide a solution in the sense that, you know, it can say, yeah, look, we've got these things, but nobody's enforcing them. What about the public square? I mean, as we look at this issue, you know, ultimately we have to win it in the public square. What are you seeing are the arguments, the rationales that are seeming to strike home and make a difference that our members could use wherever they are?
It depends on who you're talking to, but I think approaching it from a perspective of the way to peace on this question, peace in our time as it is to say, if you're going to have your rights, I don't have to be involved. And for some people, that seems like a perfectly fair answer. That's a fair resolution of the question. If you're going to have your abortion rights, at least I shouldn't have to be forced to participate. The other way to think about this is actually to flip the argument on them. When they say that that what they are seeking is access, is to say, well, right now you in fact have access. What you're arguing for, if you're arguing for a requirement that every physician, for example, be trained in how to perform abortions, or every physician be willing to and be penalized if they refuse to perform abortions, then you take away access to Hippocratic medical professionals who would share the beliefs about the sanctity of human life for the large number of people who want those exact medical professionals. So, you know, right now, if you are a woman who supports abortion, you have the ability, the easy ability, to find a doctor who agrees with those views. And if you are pro-life, you also have the ability to find a doctor who agrees with your views and approaches medicine the same way that you would like to see it approached in your case. But if the other side won the day, access would be only a one-way street.
Yeah, I often, when I'm debating this or doing interviews, I'll say, my daughter doesn't want to have her baby in one room while her OB obstetrician's doing an abortion in the next one. And that kind of puts a picture in people's minds, which isn't, you know, that seems to strike home.
And for that matter, when you get into some of those difficult cases, right, when you are, say you're a woman who, you know, you have a painful experience of finding out that you have some sort of genetic problem with your pregnancy, or there's some sort of problem. In that circumstance, you want to be able to have a doctor who's not going to be pushing you to do something that's, you know, against your own beliefs. You want to make sure that you're able to actually have a doctor who is going to support you.
You know, one of the things we have so much talk about, you know, contraceptives and abortions, but of course, right of conscience is much bigger than just those two areas and the ability to share. We had somebody call the office today, a nurse who had lost her job because she'd given a Bible to a patient who actually asked for it. And so, I mean, these things are much broader than just the abortion issue, which is probably one of the more easier things to defend. And we see those type of attacks even more continue, that we're going to move religion completely out of the public square and into a completely private domain. And unfortunately, we continue to see that trend happen. And I know you're dealing with this on campuses for us, with students that are being, you know, thrown off campuses because they're having a religious meeting and that type of thing. Comment on where you see that it is and where it's going.
It is. Well, and of course, even in the end of life context, I would just quickly note that you have in New Mexico and in other states. I know your members are probably tracking or following some of these cases where courts are holding that there's a right to physician-assisted suicide. Well, you know, when you say there's a right to physician-assisted suicide, some physician is the one who's assisting in those cases, and it's not very long before you end up with compulsion instead of a right, as it is in the abortion context.
Your right demands my duty.
Exactly right. And particularly when it's courts that are doing this and you don't have the countervailing interest written into the statute, because it's simply a judicial opinion. But on this broader question of sort of faith in the public square, and quite honestly, it seems to me like we are in a bit of a dark time right now. I was just in New York City in a law school in New York City in a debate, and there was that feeling of a bit of oppression around me as you just kind of look around at the culture. But I'm hopeful that as we go through this period, I think that, you know, the church has been through darker times before.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been times in the past when it would have been difficult to imagine that there would ever be a place called America, because you couldn't imagine the rights that we have been able to enjoy. And so I'm hopeful that we're going to come through this. But what I think I see around is, as people have felt more and more confident, simply basically just acknowledging what has been true for a while, that they don't have any personal belief, then as more and more people feel more confident in saying out loud that they don't believe, then they see less and less need for protection for religious freedom. I think, you know, for a lot of people, religious freedom was important to protect because they at least acknowledged that there was the possibility that the religious people were right.
Mm-hmm.
And as more and more people turn their backs on God, then there's fewer and fewer people who see faith as a legitimate claim, even if they disagree.
And almost an anger against those people that have it. In other words,
That's right.
You know, you see that not only from atheists, but just from people who are agnostic, that You know, it's like I don't want anybody around saying that I could be wrong. So let's eliminate you from the public square. You just keep your mouth shut and go over and do what you want to do, at least for now. Later on, we may intrude into your synagogue, your church, or your mosque. But right now, just get it out of the public square, so because I don't even want to be reminded of it.
That's exactly right. Abraham Lincoln, even dealing with this in the slavery context in 1860, he gave a speech at Cooper Union, which is a great speech that I recommend to anyone to look up. But in it, he's talking about the fact that slavery supporters were not content to simply have their right to own slaves. They wanted much more than that, and what they wanted was they wanted sedition laws. They wanted it completely illegal for anyone to speak out in opposition to slavery at all. And I think it's for much the same reason that abortion advocates today do that, because you had people who were speaking about the humanity of this person that was on the other end of their attacks. And so in order to quell their own conscience, which was speaking up to them, they needed to make sure that people were not going to be speaking out. So, you know, again, to say that's 1860. You know, we've gone through dark times before like that and had lighter times afterward. And so hopefully we will be able to look back on this period at some point in the near future and see it as a dip, but not a continued decline.
You know, I've used that excerpt from that speech in my Rite of Conscience presentation, and you take the word slavery out and substitute abortion, and it sounds like he's talking to us today. And I've noticed that, you know, in these controversial areas, first people want us to allow them, then they want us to applaud them, then they want us to endorse them, and then they want us to participate in them. Whatever the issue is, there's that push because it has to be normal. It has to be okay. In fact, you've got to prove it by actually working with us and doing it. And that's what brings a lot of the pressure to bear. Casey, I want to thank you for all you and the Alliance Defending Freedom have done. You've been a wonderful partner to us and helped us with amicus curiae briefs and helped us on campuses. And the list just goes on and on. And we are so grateful for you guys and all that you do. And I want to encourage the members of CMDA to keep you guys on the front burner of their minds and support what you're doing, because together I think we can make a difference on these issues. Speaking the truth in love, standing firmly but compassionately on these issues, trying to reach out and make a difference in our culture. And it's important, because if we lose some of these battles, we'll regret the day.
Well, thank you, Dr. Stevens. I greatly appreciate it. And frankly, I tremble at the thought of where we would be on these issues without CMDA. So thank you.
I trust you found that conversation with Casey as helpful to you as it was to me. It's great to have great partners as we fight these battles. If you want to keep up on the Right of Conscience issue, I encourage you to go to the website freedomtocare.org. That's freedom with the number 2, care, all one word, .org. That's the site we've created specifically focused on the Right of Conscience issue. There you'll be able to track legislation and be informed with alerts about how a simple note from you can help promote important laws that we're trying to get passed through Congress. Well, until we have a chance to meet again, let me tell you, CMDA is here fighting for Right of Conscience. I appreciate your help and your involvement. And if there's anything that we can do for you personally, please let us know. We're here to serve the members of CMDA. And if you're not a member of CMDA, I encourage you to join and tell a colleague as well. Just go to cmda.org. Right there on the front page, you can become part of this family as we come together to network, to learn, and to transform healthcare by transforming doctors' lives. God bless.
Christian Doctors Digest is a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on Christian Doctors Digest are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on Christian Doctors Digest reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members, and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.